Friday rolls around, here comes the weekend. Time for American Hit Radio on 90.3 WHPC.
Oh, I am living for the weekend these days.
I think we're all doing that a lot lately. The weeks have been pretty tough, but we're going to ease into this weekend with our new series here on American Hit Radio, which we are dedicating to the music of Duke Ellington. We started 2 weeks ago, so today this is show number three dedicated to the music of Duke. We're trying to present the music in a somewhat chronological order. I'm not worried about being too strict about it. But what I thought would be good for us to do today, since we spent show one talking about his youth in Washington, D.C., as it appeared in biographies about him, and the second show about him coming up to New York and settling in, I think this is a good opportunity for us to revisit his youth in Washington. I mean, and then we'll get back to New York.
Okay.
Because in many ways, Duke Ellington, I mean, we're going to be covering music that he was recording at the Cotton Club in this show. And in many ways, he was the perfect foil for the Cotton Club. The club's inherent social contradictions meant that you needed to turn a blind eye to the blatant racism of playing for an almost exclusively all-white clientele, while black entertainers operated in a faux jungle atmosphere.
Yeah.
The obvious intimations were insulting, but Ellington's youth inured him from feeling that way. Growing up in Washington, D.C. left him with a sense of equality that saw no color barrier. And so he dealt with things, making subtle adjustments along the way to ensure the betterment of the situation for both himself and his band. For this show, we review his youth in Washington, D.C., but in his own words, from his own, I don't know if you would call it an autobiography.
But maybe just a biography?
Well, no, he wrote it, so it's a memoir, really.
Okay, a memoir. Let's...
And then we can discuss his earliest performing at Harlem's Cotton Club. So, from the book, I just dropped in my papers, okay. This is all from Duke's book called Music Is My Mistress. I was pampered and pampered and spoiled rotten by all the women in the family, aunts and cousins, but my mother never took her eyes off precious little me, her jewel, until I was 4 years old when I proceeded to the front lawn with some authority to examine the rose bushes, stumbled over the lawnmower, fell on a piece of broken milk bottle, and cut the fourth finger of my left hand. This, of course, was a major emergency that called for the whole family to decide what should be done. The mark is still there, and I think I got pneumonia in the same year. My first awareness of how serious that was when they called two doctors. There may have been more because I know my mother wanted every doctor in Washington to come and work the miracle of saving her little child. She stayed at my bedside night and day until the fever broke.
Boy, that was a hell of a cut.
Right. School went all right, I suppose, because I made my grades in spite of my enthusiasm for baseball. One day, a boy was demonstrating his skill at batting, and I turned around for some reason or other and got hit with that bat. Bam, right in the back of the head. My mother saw it happen.
Not again.
Right. She rushed into the street and rushed me off to the doctors. It hurt at the moment, and I suppose the mark is still there, but I soon got over it. With this, however, my mother decided that I should take piano lessons.
Keep you out of trouble.
My piano teacher, Miss Clink Scales, that really was her name, got paid several times a week for many weeks for those lessons, but I missed more than I took because of my enthusiasm for playing ball and running and racing through the street. That I remember very well, because when she had her piano recital with all her pupils in the church, I was the only one who could not play his part.
Oopsie.
So Miss Clinkscales had to play the treble, and I just played the umpy-dump bottom. The umpy-dump bottom was, of course, the foundation and understanding of that part of piano playing that I later learned to like. When I was old enough, I was sent off to Sunday school as well. I didn't understand it so much then, in spite of the fact that it gave me a wonderful feeling of security. Believing gave me that. As though I were some very, very special child, my mother would say, "Edward, you are blessed. You don't have to worry about anything. Edward, you are blessed." Do I believe that I am blessed? Of course I do. In the first place, my mother told me so, so many, many times. And when she did, it was always quietly and confidently. She was very soft-spoken, and I knew that anything she told me was true. No matter where I was or what the conditions, my subconscious seemed very much aware of it. So until this day, I really don't have any fears beyond what I might do to hurt or offend someone else. There have been so many extraordinary and inexplicable circumstances in my life. I have always seemed to encounter the right people in the right places at the right time and doing the right thing to give me the kind of instruction and guidance that I needed. I gotta go forward a few pages here. Aha. Now he talks about his next piano teacher, Doc Perry. Wore glasses and looked very much like the kids try to look today. He was intelligent, had beautiful posture at all times, sitting, walking, in a pool room or playing the piano, and talked with a sort of semi-continental finesse. He was extremely dignified, clean, neat, and had impeccably manicured nails and hands. When playing the piano, he had that form athletes have. He was respected by musicians, show people, and the layman as well. Doc was an impressive sight no matter what he was doing. And in spite of his own masterly digital dexterity, he respected any musician, school or ear. It was all a matter of taste. He felt that if the composer wrote it that way, then that's the way that the composer would like it played. I met him like all the other kids who went to dances. And when he heard me play, I think he saw possibilities for me in piano playing. As my drawing and painting teacher at high school, Mr. Dodson, used to say, "You have the ability. Now all you have to do is apply yourself." What they meant was apply yourself and learn everything you can about music. I used to go up to Doc Perry's house almost every day, sit there in a glow of enchantment until he'd pause and explain some passage. Being an educated man of intelligence and tolerance, he had the patience to share with me his theories and observations. He also could switch from his own precise, clean style to that of any other piano player he'd heard. He was absolutely the most perfect combination of assets I could have encountered at that time. He first taught me what I called a system of reading and lead and recognizing the chords so that I could have a choice in the development of my ornamentation. He was my piano parent, and nothing was too good for me to try. Even if I didn't learn to play it, I knew how it was done. Doc Perry was probably the first in the parade where I found the right person in the right frame of mind to do all that he could for me and my advancement. He never charged me 5 cents, and he served food and drink throughout the whole thing. How does one pay off that kind of indebtedness? I became not only the relief piano player to Doc Perry, but also Lewis Brown, Lester Dishman, and Sticky Mac. I also worked in about the number 5 band for people like Lewis Thomas and Russell Wooding, who had the class work. We moved out into the society world, and I remember playing at Mrs. Dyer's, a dance hall where all the nice young society kids used to go. Lewis Thomas furnished the music for it all the time, and I was lucky to go in there. That was where I started throwing my hands up in the air, trying to look like Lucky Roberts, whom I had seen at the Howard Theater, and they all said, "Oh, yes, Duke's a great pianist. Send him back again." This is although I still knew only about 4 numbers. See, sometimes looking good is all that you really need. After I had been playing for him a couple of years, Lewis Thomas hit me on another job I can never forget. It was out at Ashland Country Club. Nothing but millionaires, and there was nobody to play but me. I sat there and played the whole length of the gig without a drummer or even a banjo player. "You're playing by yourself tonight," Thomas told me. "It'll be mostly atmosphere, just under conversation music. Collect $100 and bring me $90. He was paying me $10 a night at that time, but I thought to myself, what? $100 a night? I gave him his $90, but the very next day, I went down to the telephone office and arranged for a Music for All Occasions ad in the telephone book. It was during the war, and there were a lot of people from out of town, war workers, who didn't know Meyer Davis and Lewis Thomas from Duke Ellington. My ad looked just like theirs, and I began to get work and give it. It got so that I would sometimes send out 4 or 5 bands a night and work in them, too. I had real good business since then. I bought a car and a house and lived up on Sherman Avenue. In partnership with Errol Conway, I was also operating a sign painting business on T Street between 6th and 7th. When customers came for posters to advertise a dance, I would ask them what they were doing about their music. When they wanted to hire a band, I would ask them, who's painting your signs? Meanwhile, Percy Johnson was a drummer and a buddy of mine. His nickname was Brushes. One day he invited me over to his house just across from that sign shop on T Street. You got to listen to this, he said when we got there. He had a Playo piano, and he put on a roll by James P. Johnson. This was, of course, an entirely new avenue of adventure for me, and I went back there every day and listened. Percy slowed the mechanism down so that I could see which keys on the piano were going down as I digested Johnson's wonderful sounds, and I played with it until I had his Carolina Shout down pat, and then Percy would go out on the town with me and show me off. I really had it perfect, so that when James P. Johnson himself came to Washington to play at Convention Hall, my cheering section and pals waited until he played Carolina Shout and then insisted that I get up on the stand and cut him. I was scared stiff, but James P. was not only a master, he was also a great man for encouraging youngsters. He went along with the Hall scene, and when I finished Carolina Shout, he applauded too. The nucleus of the early band that I had was with the Miller Brothers. Then Otto Hardwick, who later became Toby, joined us. He was playing bass fiddle, and he was so small, his father used to carry the instrument to work for him. When he got a C melody saxophone, I began to send him out on the other jobs, and he was soon known as one of the best saxophone players in town. Artie Wetzel, the trumpet player, used to work with us too, and for years, he was one of the band's most indispensable members. Elmer Snowden came in with his banjo, and around this time I met Juan Tizal, the trombonist, who came to the Howard Theater with a band from Puerto Rico, led by Marie Lucas. This group inspired us very much because all the musicians doubled on different instruments, something that was extraordinary in those days. Tizal enters the story again a few years later, but the year before, in 1919, Sonny Greer came to Washington after playing drums in a trio with Fats Waller at Asbury Park. So you see, all these people fall together. Duke has now got the nucleus. He's really got everything that he needs for a complete band. So when he goes to New York, he's ready. And he's got the right frame of mind after coming, living in Washington, D.C., and the type of atmosphere that he had with his parents. So he was perfect for being able to do sweet music. He was perfect for being able to do, you know, hard jazz. But in the beginning, the sweet music really did well that he learned that. And we'll start our show by playing 2 tracks that qualify as Duke Ellington and his orchestra doing exactly that. A couple of sweet jazz tunes. First up is 3 Little Words. And because I talked so much, we'll play 2 back to back. We'll follow that with Ring Dem Bells on 90.3 WHPC. Here's Duke Ellington. Thank you.
That's all I'd live for the rest of my day. And what I feel in my heart, they tell sincerely. No other words can tell it half so clearly. Three little words, eight little letters, which simply mean I love you.
Some rather excellent examples of Sweet Jazz, the first track with a vocalist named Jimmy Miller doing the singing. Duke actually writes about this period when those songs were being recorded, again, from his book, Music Is My Mistress. He goes, so far as we were concerned, the engagement at the Cotton Club was of the utmost significance because as a result of its radio wire, we were heard nationally and internationally. In 1929, we appeared simultaneously at the Cotton Club and in Florence Ziegfeld's Showgirl, which had a Gershwin score and introduced An American in Paris and Liza. This was valuable in terms of both experience and prestige. The following year, Irving Mills succeeded in arranging for us to accompany Maurice Chevalier at the Fulton Theater and play a concert selection of our compositions.
Nice.
This was about the only time I ever used a baton. In 1932, we went to Hollywood to appear in Check and Double Check, a film featuring the then popular radio team of Amos and Andy. The big song in it was Three Little Words by Harry Ruby and Bert Kalmar, but an instrumental of mine called Ring Them Bells also became very popular, which is the track we just heard. It was taken up by other bands, and for a considerable time, it was a much requested item. Now, obviously proving that he could do sweet jazz that swung, like on Ring Them Bells, Ellington also proved adept at performing like hotter and more experimental jazz as well, lacing his music with exciting and still controversial African-American musical devices like distortion, as seen in the gut bucket trumpet playing of Bubba Miley around this time. Check that out in the opening solo of the song Flaming Youth that we're about to play. And also dissonance, like part of the main instrumental hook of The Mooch, where it's going to sound all of a sudden as though the music goes dissonant, then radically shifting time signatures as well, Creole Rhapsody, and a funkier, bluesier rhythm than other big bands on the radio could muster. Songs like Saturday Night Function. This flexibility and mastery of a number of styles, often creatively juxtaposed in the same piece, enabled the Ellington Orchestra to provide listeners with sounds they were used to, yet have them accept an increasingly African-American-derived sound. That's why I wanted to go back to the beginning a little bit. So let's play three of those tracks we just mentioned back-to-back on American at Radio 90.3 WHPC. Here are, in order, The Mooch, Flaming Youth, and Saturday Night Function.
Thank you.
another side of Duke Ellington from around this era. The late 20s, 1929, 1930 is where we are, timeline-wise, if you're interested. Let's meet a couple of people from Ellington's times, his contemporaries around this point in time. Again, from his own book. This is regarding Fletcher Henderson. When I was just a scuffling little piano player around Washington, I was playing in a joint called Jack's on 7th Street, and Fletcher Henderson came in with Coleman Hawkins. They were playing in the city with Bessie Smith, and they came by to visit. I was honored to have these celebrities with me, and everything was going along fine until a fight started in the place.
Uh-oh.
It began with a little throwing of things and ended up with gun shooting and Fletcher, Hawk, and me under the bandstand. I don't remember anything more about that first meeting. But Fletcher was a big inspiration to me. He was the band I always wanted mine to sound like when I got ready to have a big band, and that's what we tried to achieve the first chance we had with that many musicians. Obviously, a lot of other musicians wanted the same thing, and when Benny Goodman was ready for a big band, he sent for Fletcher Henderson to do his arrangements. That was consistent with good taste, and I'm always glad to be identified with those who have good taste. Let's meet the band members. Play one of them anyway, and then I will play some tracks and we'll move on. This is regarding Otto Hardwick, who was a saxophone player with Duke Ellington when they were the Washingtonians and eventually became a member of Duke Ellington and his Cotton Club Orchestra. Otto Hardwick was known as the little brother of John Hardwick in Washington, D.C. during the 20s. I think John played banjo, and he always felt responsible for watching over him. Otto was considered to be a nice kid and to have music potential. I forget exactly when, but on one of those occasions when the more mature saxophone players were all engaged, we turned to him. Of course, his first appearance was a real surprise to all of us. He read very well and played even better, so he was no longer looked on as too young to be called for a job. And he was called on more and more often. I had the good fortune to be a friend of his, so he gradually became like my first chair saxophone around Washington. This is the guy whose father had to help him carry his instrument around.
Oh, because he was too little.
Right. And then one day, he, Sonny Greer, and I came to New York. He was with us at the beginning of our engagement at Barron's. Otto, or Toby as he liked to be called, was Mr. C. Melody himself, and nobody ever quite captured the overall illusion of his sound. His tone was one of my first outstanding sound identities. The C Melody saxophone was his instrument, but later he added the baritone sax to his accessories. He was one of the first, if not the first, to do so, and he was an inspiration to other baritone players, notably Harry Carney, who was soon to be acknowledged as the symbol of the baritone saxophone. When Harry heard Toby play baritone, he ran, not walked, to the nearest baritone saxophone and went to work mastering it, and has never looked back.
Nice.
A couple of tracks from Duke Ellington and his Cotton Club Orchestra from this era. We will play Bandana Babies and Rent Party Blues on American at Radio 90.3 WHPC.
Bandana Babies, wa-da-da-da-da-da-da-da. Bandana Babies, wa-da-da-da-da-da-da-da. Bandana Babies, wa-da-da-da-da-da-da. Thank you.
right, right there we heard back-to-back Bandana Babies and Rent Party Blues. And by the way, I should mention that although we had been discussing Otto Hardwick, that is not him who is playing on those tracks, but his replacement, Harry Carney, as Duke was talking about how he had basically, you know, ran, not walked, to get to an instrument after what he had learned from watching Otto play. Around this time, they put out a promotional record, 78 RPM, of course, which means it was limited to about maybe, I think, 4 minutes or so per side. And what it was it was supposed to be like basically an advertisement for Duke at the Cotton Club. And it was called A Night at the Cotton Club, nice. Parts 1 and Part 2. So we'll hear it now in its entirety, both parts, on 90.3 WHPC.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to our famous Cotton Club. Great to see so many friends here tonight enjoying themselves in spite of the cover charge. And if you can spare a minute from your merrymaking, I'd like to have the pleasure of introducing the greatest living master of jungle music, the rip-roaring harmony hound, none other than Duke Ellington. Take your bow, Dukie. First number tonight's going to play a brand new little tune entitled The Cotton Club Stomp. Let her go. You never listen to so much music, admit it. This certainly is a gala night. Tables filled with smiling faces. Everybody happy, plenty of dancing for all of us. Which reminds us, have you ever heard Dukie play that low-down Misty Morning? Let her go! What a mob, what a mob. Never have seen the club so jammed. Not a spot the size of a dime on the floor. And why, I ask you, because there is only one band like this every 1,000 years. A real Hades in Harlem. What's that? Oh, yes. Lady at the ringside table asks us to play Gone to Town. Everybody ready? Let her go, boys. Surprise for you, Harmonica Charlie is here, and how he plays that thing. Let's give him a great big hand, boys. People wanted to do things, go places, see sights, spend money, need I say more? It's marvelous the way you've all warmed up to our little show. How I do love applause. Dookie loves applause, don't you, Dookie?
Have a fun, Dookie.
Now, in response to your enthusiasm, they're going to take your breath away with a brand new dance entitled Freeze and Melt. Freeze them, boys.
Okay, so despite the long introduction, sorry about that, but I really did want to cover Duke's childhood in his own words to set up the story and also to basically show why he had a perfect inclination.
I have to say, I cannot ignore the inherent racism, though, of that last segment, with starting from the name of the club, the Cotton Club, the introduction of the band as jungle music.
Right. Yeah. Just the casual use of Dookie.
Yeah.
Even it's, but it was obviously a very different times. That was 90 years ago.
I know. I'm just saying.
So, but believe it or not, but I'd like to mention, like, the songs that you heard in that, the two medleys on the two sides started with a track called Cotton Club Stomp, edited into Misty Mornin', And side two, the songs are actually introduced as Go Into Town and Freeze and Melt. I've got the full version of Cotton Club Stomp, so we can go out with that. We'll play two tracks now. Cotton Club Stomp, as it was recorded in the studio, and Snake Hip Dance. Thanks, folks. Hope you enjoyed this. We will be back next week with further coverage of Duke as we start to get into the details of some of his songwriting as it began to improve and diversify. See you then.
Thank you.